Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What the Affordable Care Act means for jobs, the markets come more in line with the economy, and $250 for sneakers? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Tuesday, February 4th. It is lovely, as always, to have you with us. And we're going to start our show in Washington, D.C., with some big picture stuff about the U.S. economy. The Congressional Budget Office, which is something like a nonpartisan scorekeeper in Washington, gave its forecast of what the economy will look like over the next decade. The headline, the economy's growing and the deficit's shrinking. At least for now. The CBO also dug into the economic effects of the Affordable Care Act. The headline there, they say some Americans will choose to drop out of the workforce or scale back their hours, roughly the equivalent of 2 million full-time jobs. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
According to this new analysis, some Americans will choose to scale back how much they work. Thanks to Obamacare, they'll decide to go part-time. And a reason for that is because as your income goes down, the help you can get from the government goes up. Catherine Baker, who's a professor of health economics at Harvard, puts it another way.
If your subsidy for purchasing health insurance goes down as your income rises, that provides some disincentive to have higher income.
So it could be advantageous for an individual to work a job that pays less than 4 times the federal poverty level. That's about $46,000 a year.
That's not a wealthy person, but it covers a bigger share of the distribution of people than you might think if you were just thinking about poor people.
We're talking about tens of millions of Americans. Some will work less, knowing they can get health insurance through government-run exchanges. Others will stop working altogether. So 2 million fewer full-time workers by 2017 sounds bad, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to be an economist for you, but this is sort of an on-the-one-hand, on-the-other-hand kind of answer.
That's Craig Garthwaite, a professor at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. On the one hand, he says,
we do want people to participate in the labor force.
On the other hand, Americans will be able to pick jobs that are good fits, he says, without having to worry about losing their health insurance. And some older Americans will be able to retire sooner. People in their 60s would have had a hard time finding affordable coverage on their own, says Jonathan Gruber. He's an economist at MIT who helped write the Affordable Care Act.
These are people who were sort of chained to their desk by the failures in the individual insurance market.
Now, the CBO says its predictions are subject to substantial uncertainty. Well, that comes with the territory, given all the uncertainty about how implementation of the Affordable Care Act will play out. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The markets closed up modestly today, but it has not been a great start to the year. The Dow is about 1,000 points lower than it was January 1st. The S&P 500 is off about 75 points. We've been hearing a lot lately about how a market correction is coming. Technically, a correction is a change of 10% or more, but we talk a lot on this show about how the markets are not the same thing as the economy. So maybe a correction would put the markets more in line with everything else. Is that what's ahead? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has our story.
Historically speaking, yes. Alec Young is with S&P Capital IQ.
The S&P 500 has averaged a correction every 18 months. And currently, we haven't had one since 2011. So we're about 28 months overdue.
Plus, many economic indicators, like manufacturing and unemployment, indicate stocks should be a little lower, says Bill Stone, an investment strategist at PNC Wealth Management.
We will get a 10% pullback sometime. Whether this is it or not is hard to say, but you ought to be ready for it.
Still, we're probably not talking about a crash, because companies' profits are pretty much in line with current stock values, says economist Heidi Shierholz with the Economic Policy Institute.
The best measures of long-run stock market fundamentals, the price-to-earnings ratio, is not in bubble territory.
But those profits don't necessarily mean a strong economy. In fact, says Sherholtz, a lot of Wall Street's success has come at the expense of Main Street's economy.
The very weak labor market actually strongly reduces wage growth and is one of the reasons corporate profits are doing so well right now.
As for investors, PNC's Bill Stone says they should try to sit tight.
That is, unfortunately, I guess, the price of owning what has long-term been the best-performing asset class is you probably need Mailocks along the way.
Not the extra-strength Mailocks we needed in 2008, though. Most economists expect the market will end 2014 a little higher than where it started. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yeah, small sigh of relief out there. We'll have details when we do the numbers. There's big news at the world's biggest software maker. Microsoft has finally announced its pick for the top job. Satya Nadella, a 22-year veteran of Microsoft, will be the new CEO. But don't imagine all that experience made him a shoo-in. Microsoft took nearly 6 months to announce the decision, in part because executives spent time looking for their new CEO outside the company. It's a big debate the companies often have when appointing a successor. Do you choose an old company hand or a fresh face? Marketplace's Quina Kim has the story.
Microsoft is a case study of what so many aging technology companies, from Intel to Hewlett-Packard, are going through. Michael Cusimano is a professor at MIT, and he says these old line companies still bring in a ton of cash, but they're slow when it comes to innovation. Oftentimes, he says companies like Microsoft consider bringing in an outsider to provide that spark.
I think they juggled all these balls in the air and concluded that it would be too difficult for an outsider to come in. You really need someone that understands the culture and the people to really get the most out of the organization.
Cusimano says that Microsoft seems to have found somebody who can keep the company pumping money and hopefully turn it in the right direction. Bob Sutton is the author of Scaling Up Excellence, and he thinks picking an insider was the right decision.
There's actually a large body of academic research which shows that when outsiders come in, they do worse.
Sutton says former GE CEOs who went on to head up other companies did consistently worse than insiders, and that trend holds across industries. Sutton says the problem is outsiders often think if they lay off departments and issue mandates, a turnaround is sure to happen. But he says that approach ignores the human factor.
Every organization has its own quirks in history and culture, and it turns out that it takes a very long time to learn where, if you will, the bodies are buried and where the good things are.
But insiders can be tainted by company culture. Harlan Platt teaches turnarounds at Northeastern University.
I got into the business of turnarounds by asking this silly question: how do you find a good manager at a bad company?
Platt says Microsoft's poor culture of innovation suggests that a company man might not be the best bet. In San Francisco, I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
There are a lot of challenges facing Satya Nadella in his new job, mostly figuring out which parts of Microsoft's sprawling business he'll choose to expand or cut back. To learn a little more about Nadella and the company itself, we are going to turn to our in-house expert, Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Lizzie.
So Satya Nadella's been at Microsoft for 22 years. What's he been doing there?
Well, he's been working on a couple things that we've heard of. Bing, you may have heard of. He worked on their search engine. He developed their cloud computing platform, which you and I, you know, maybe we've heard of this, maybe not. It's called Azure. It's kind of a competitor, what Microsoft hopes would be a competitor to things like Amazon. Basically, a way for us to store all of our information on the cloud if we're a business.
This is really important because the way most consumers interact with Microsoft or have has been through Windows and the kind of software you run on your desktop.
And oh, yeah.
The way Microsoft wants to grow is either tablet stuff, consumer-facing, or the cloud. Tell me about those two challenges and where someone who's worked on the cloud fits into this picture.
Okay. So as you and I know, as probably Microsoft Word and Excel users of the past, the company is a huge software company, right? And they're moving a lot of this software onto the cloud, basically a way for us to access these kinds of powerful tools, either as a business or as a single consumer via the internet. Now, there's another side of this, right? There's Xbox. There's the Microsoft Surface, which not very many people I know have. And then there's the Windows Phone, which is, you know, product of Nokia now, and a space for Microsoft to grow in the hardware area. My guess is that Satya Nadella is going to work on the former more than the latter. Of course, there are some
cloud business?
Yes, the cloud business. Now, you know, there are going to be some consumer-facing products that Microsoft will, I assume, continue to make, right? Xbox, maybe the Windows Phone, which everybody loves but nobody has. The Surface, maybe. But what Satya Nadella is going to be focused on is big data and innovation in this area of cloud computing.
Ben, Bill Gates built Microsoft. He's stepping down from his role as chairman. There's going to be a new chairman. But Gates is still going to be there 3 days a week, kind of as an advisor. Who is really the boss here?
Okay, so it is a little bit confusing, right? And a little bit weird that Bill Gates is kind of still around. But I think what this kind of like tag team Bill Gates, Satya Nadella, Batman and Robin thing might be about is Bill Gates is sort of getting back involved in the company. He's going to be working in the company 3 days a week instead of dealing with investors. And he's going to be sort of a support to Satya Nadella. He's going to be, to all of us, a reminder that the person who built this company is still involved in the day-to-day. Now, as to whether or not that means that Satya Nadella is the true leader of the company, I think that Nadella has demonstrated his ability to lead. I mean, the area that he ran, the cloud computing part of the business, is a $19 billion business. So I think he has the chops to be the true leader of the company, and I think he'll step up.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Coming up, what kind of person buys Dior sneakers?
I think they want to be active and healthy. And even if they're not active and healthy, they want to look like they are.
But first, let's do the numbers. Hey, it's the happy music. The Dow Jones Industrial Average righted the ship to the tune of 72 points, 0.5% to close at 15,445. The NASDAQ quietly added 34 points, 0.8% to finish at 4031. And the S&P 500 also in the money, up 13 points, 0.75% to close at 1755. We've been talking about Microsoft. Investors had mixed feelings about them naming a new CEO. Shares of the tech giant seesawed throughout the day, eventually ending down 0.3%. Another company struggling to define itself, Radio Shack, also made some news today. It announced it would close 500 stores in the coming months. Shares of Radio Shack fizzled nearly 5%. Shares of JCPenney plunged 10% after the retailer announced a 2% increase in same-store sales over the holidays. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.63%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee addresses protecting consumer information. Can data breaches be prevented? We have him to thank for Naked Lunch. Author William S. Burroughs was born 100 years ago. And don't take weather information for granted, because no one wants a bad hair day. Tomorrow is National Weather Person's Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We're going to talk now about retail banks, the kind that serve customers like you and me. The NAACP has a new survey out showing that less than 4% of the upper managers of these banks are African American. There are plenty of diverse workers in the mid and lower level jobs, but the survey says it would take more than a decade, maybe even two, for them to be promoted into upper management. One idea is to fast track minority workers. Sally Herships reports.
Addie Perkins-Williamson is a consultant to the banking industry. She's also African-American, and her first job out of grad school about 15 years ago was at a big national bank.
That was where I first learned that there were written rules and unwritten rules.
Written rules, like everyone has the same shot at a promotion, and unwritten rules.
The time frames for moving up for, let's say, white males versus everybody else were a little bit different. It was expected that if you were a woman or a person of color, it would take you longer.
The NAACP says bias like this is one reason why there are so few African-American or Latino workers in upper management, though there are plenty in the middle. So it says, why not just promote those workers through the ranks faster? That's what fast-tracking is. It's not an overnight promotion to CEO.
Fast-tracking doesn't take the form of literally skipping milestones and rites of passage, but breezing through them.
Steve Blader teaches management at NYU Stern School of Business. Still, you're still fulfilling that mid-level management position. You just might be there for a year instead of four.
Exactly.
None of the banks I contacted wanted to discuss fast-tracking. But Steve Blader says even if it isn't officially acknowledged, fast-tracking is common, and so are the problems it can cause if someone from any demographic is fast-tracked. Imagine you're a worker watching your colleague get promoted quickly.
And as a result, I'm going to become more complacent because I'm going to start to feel like, what's the point?
Blader says that resentment can lead to a less productive workplace. And a large and difficult question. Is it fair to fast-track certain demographic groups? Peter Capelli teaches management at Wharton. He says, hold on a minute. The rules of the workplace have changed. Fast-tracking happens all the time with all kinds of workers. Only about a quarter of promotions happen the old-fashioned way.
People are advancing faster than they did a generation ago. So everybody who gets to the top is on something like a fast track, at least compared to what you would have seen a generation ago.
Capelli says fast-tracking specific groups of employees can work, but the business case needs to be spelled out for employees.
Just as in the past we needed more people with marketing expertise, you know, now we need more people who look like our customer base.
Addie Perkins-Williamson, the corporate consultant, agrees, and she helps companies get fast-tracking right. First, she says, make sure you're promoting outstanding workers, but she says that's not usually the problem.
What tends to happen is they don't have enough relationships.
Especially if they're workers with new responsibilities.
So you're waiting 2 years to get the IT support you need because you don't have enough relationship with the head of IT.
So Williamson says companies need to support, even engineer those relationships. Five big banks declined interviews on fast tracking, but several said diversity is an area they know needs work. Workers of color were skittish, too. They didn't want to be seen as troublemakers. Stacia Washington, managing director of First Foundation Bank in California, was willing to talk. She told me how she became one of the 4% of African Americans in upper management. And
yes, I've been fast tracked throughout my entire career.
And did you ever notice grumbling around you from other coworkers?
I never paid attention to it. I've always had my head down. I mean, you know, what other people think about you is none of your business.
Washington says for her career, the support of a sponsor was essential. And while experts don't see eye to eye on fast tracking, they do agree diversity programs will only be effective if they're supported from the top. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
President Obama held up an iPad this morning at a school in Maryland. It's part of his announcement to get better tech to almost all students within 5 years. Better internet speed, more software, devices. The program is called Connect Ed. It's getting money from places like the Federal Communications Commission, which has pledged $2 billion over 2 years. And also from tech companies. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the story.
The president came prepared with his best soundbite.
In a country where we expect free Wi-Fi with our coffee, we should definitely demand it in our schools.
That's especially true because many of the high-stakes tests students will take in coming years are administered online. Evan Marwell runs Education Superhighway. According to his group's research, about a third of schools have enough broadband to give the most advanced tests. Another third could give more basic online exams. And a third couldn't give online tests at all.
That's a problem.
The money schools get comes from a $2.4 billion fund called E-Rate. That's money phone companies collect as fees. But so far, only half of it goes to broadband connections. Some of it pays for cell phones, and a quarter of it pays for phone service, landlines.
You know, it made sense back at the beginning of the program, right? Because how did most schools get on the Internet back in 1996? Dial-up. But today, how many schools get on the Internet with dial-up?
And with the E-Rate funds that do pay for broadband, it turns out we don't really know exactly how much bandwidth schools are getting for that money. Telecom providers don't report that to the FCC. Why not? Here's Danielle Kell, who studies tech policy at the New America Foundation.
They don't actually ask the providers for that precise information.
She's hoping the agency will change that don't ask, don't tell practice. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Also, a note, I talked to Janet Shea yesterday. She's a voice of Frozen's Princess Anna. We misidentified where she's a star. It's in Taiwan. We are coming up on Fashion Week in New York, which probably calls to mind models on the catwalk in impossibly high stilettos. But this season, nope. It's a more, shall we say, athletic look, with sneakers even popping up on the Paris runways. So if you spend your time in yoga pants, you're going to love this. We turn to Kate Betts whenever we have a fashion industry question. Kate, good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
So on the runways in Paris, the fanciest couture shows, there were sneakers? Well, what? What's up with that?
I know, it's crazy, right? Chanel Couture and Dior Couture, probably the two most established French fashion houses, showed sneakers that were obviously very high-end. I think they were probably hand-embroidered or something. They're obviously responding to street fashion because that inspires a lot of the runways. But I think they're also responding to a shift in sort of codes and manners and the way that we present ourselves.
What does that tell you about who they're trying to target and who has the money to spend on both high-end fashion and then the things that trickle down from that?
Well, it's funny because I think they're trying. I mean, obviously, those are very high-priced items, and couture is the very highest level of the fashion market. But I think what they're trying to say is that this is a kind of a new attitude, and they're responding to both. I think it's the millennials and also the baby boomers who are dressing in this very casual way. But I think it's also for the higher end client, it's that they want a more fluid way of dressing for their lifestyle.
Is that lifestyle aspirational? Are we talking juice cleanses and soul cycle here?
Yeah, that's the lifestyle. It's the wellness look, you know. I think they want to be active and healthy. And even if they're not active and healthy, they want to look like they are. I think it's interesting to notice that activewear for 2013 was up 9%, whereas general apparel was just up 1%. So these are the clothes people are buying.
Yeah, when you think about this as a market, how much room do either designers or brands like Nike, Under Armour, who sell to broader swaths of the population, how much room do they have to expand?
Well, I think there's a lot of room because, first of all, I think there is interest in activewear at pretty much every level of the market. And also, don't forget that the activewear apparel market is also driven by the advancement in technology because a lot of these fabrics are really, really high tech. So anytime a new kind of weave or fiber is introduced, there's a whole new potential for development there.
We're looking forward toward New York Fashion Week. Look in your crystal ball. Tell me what we're going to see.
Well, I'm sure that this trend will be, you know, pretty strong on the runways. I'm sure that there's also going to be a lot of collaborations between designers and big apparel firms. Like the recent Riccardo Tisci, who's the designer for Givenchy, signed a big deal with Nike, and he designed a pair of sneakers that's $225 for Nike, you know. So anything's possible, I guess, nowadays.
Is this stuff going so far that Nike's got to worry about Dior sneaking in and stealing their customers?
I don't think they have to worry about Dior, but I think they probably have to worry about all of the new labels that are going to pop up.
Kate Betts is the author of Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama and the Power of Style. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, it turns out that flirting makes you more loyal. Well, at least in a business sense. A professor at Harvard Business School found that exposure to a new brand actually made the customer more committed to their favorite brand. For example, the researchers asked people who were diehard Coca-Cola drinkers to name some good qualities of Pepsi and vice versa. In both cases, doing so made the customers return more fiercely to their preferred brand. So, I don't know, maybe just don't try this on your spouse. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow righted the ship to the tune of 72 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ added 34 points, 0.8%. And the S&P 500 also in the money, up 13 points, 0.75%. Nancy Fargali and John Ketchum are producers on our Marketplace desk. Ariana Tobin and Raghu Manavalan are our digital producers. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.